I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. It should go without saying that racial discrimination and bigotry harms Black people, people of color, in this country. Our guest, Heather McGee, says that white people are harmed, too, by many of the same discriminatory laws and policies. She writes in her new book, The Sum of Us, What Racism Costs Everyone and How We Can Prosper Together, that she spent 2 years talking to Americans all across the country. She found that white people largely believe in zero sum when it comes to race and wealth, that if African Americans gained ground, whites were going to lose out. And that included voting and housing, employment, education. Her book deconstructs and debunks that myth. Heather McGee is former president of the progressive think tank Demos and now chairs the board of Color of Change. And she joins us on Radio Times to talk about this moment that we're in and how to create what she calls the solidarity dividend. Heather McGee, it's been a bunch of years. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good to be with you, Marty.
Let's start with swimming pools, which you write about in this book. And back in the 20th century, a lot of cities, communities built swimming pools for the public, for people living in those particular neighborhoods. You focus on a pool that was in Montgomery, Alabama, the Oaks Park Pool. What was that pool like?
It was one of these grand resort-style pools that could hold over 1,000 swimmers. It was rimmed by oak trees. It was really sort of the beating heart of the city of Montgomery, where people met and fell in love and would spend all their days back before air conditioning was widely had in homes. It was really essential for public health and for the sort of fabric of the community.
And it was for whites only. What happened when the courts ruled against segregation?
Well, this public good that had been paid for by everybody's tax dollars then was drained. The city council voted to close the Oak Park pool to drain out the water. They backed up trucks of dirt and filled it in. And they went so far as to actually close the entire park and the entire Parks and Recreation Department of the city. And Montgomery kept their public park system closed for a decade rather than let Black people participate as well.
And let Black people and white people swim together in the same swimming pool.
Yes, that's exactly right. It was this visceral and legislated fear of Black people meeting, seeing each other's humanity, possibly falling in love, of things that were once publicly funded and luxurious and well supported. But with a caveat, with an asterisk, that was for whites only. And of course, the reason why I tell this story is not because I'm obsessed with swimming pools.
Sure.
It's because I'm obsessed with what they stand in for public goods in general. And the book tells the story of how we lost not only the pools, but the drained pool politics that followed the civil rights movement in America has cost us so much as a country economically.
And do you see what happened to these pools? It wasn't the only one in Montgomery, Alabama, as this sort of zero-sum game thinking?
That's right. The zero-sum idea is the idea that there's an us and a them within our society, and we're on opposite and competing teams, racial teams, and progress for people of color has to come at white folks' expense. And sociologists have identified that this worldview is quite predominant among white Americans, much less so among people of color. We don't think that our progress has to come at white folks' expense. But if you think about it that way, if you would rather destroy a public good than share it, if you'd rather be against a public benefit or a change in the rules because it might help your opposing team and that would therefore threaten your own status, then you end up with a lot of self-sabotage, which helps to explain so many of the ills of our country's society today.
You write, the narrative that white people should see the well-being of people of color as a threat to their own is one of the most powerful subterranean stories in America. And obviously, you want to take it out of the subterranean part of our history and our country and put it above ground, literally.
That's right. That's right. I think, I spent nearly 20 years, as you said in the introduction, and then working at helping to build and then running an economic think tank that addresses inequality. And we were really focused on changing the rules around taxes and trade and wages and labor, investments in college affordability and childcare and healthcare. And we knew that there were racial disparities around all of these issues, that generally speaking, even when the numbers were bad for everyone, people of color were struggling more. But that's the way we saw race and racism, as sort of there's inequality caused by economic policy, and then the legacy and persistence of discrimination and disadvantage makes inequality worse for people of color. But when I set out to write the book, I was testing a thought that I had that came from the experience of trying to bring good economic policy research to policymakers and have them make better economic policy decisions, that maybe racism in our politics and our policymaking was actually driving inequality for everyone.
Well, in fact, you begin your book with this question, why can't we have nice things?
Yeah.
Who's exactly. The we? Is that all of us?
Yeah. I mean, well, the nice things are things like universal health care and a well-funded public school in every neighborhood and reliable modern infrastructure, wages that can consistently keep workers out of poverty. And so the we is most Americans, not the ultra-wealthy and the self-interested ultra-wealthy, but most Americans are struggling with the effects of a government and a sort of business class that often denies these nice things. It means people of color who are disproportionately among the impoverished and the uninsured, but it also means white people who are the largest group of the impoverished and the uninsured. It's all of us who have at some point in time asked ourselves that question, as we've seen other countries with a fraction of our wealth and a fraction of our sort of, you know, chest beating about how great we are, manage to solve basic problems, right? Why, you know, we are now fighting to get a bill passed with the American Jobs Plan that would rip up all the lead pipes in the country and replace them. And that feels like it shouldn't be a massive partisan fight. That should be basic maintenance of your country for your people. And yet we've let our infrastructure degrade in many ways because it is a common investment. And as our country has become more diverse, white people particularly have sort of turned their backs on the formula and the politics that brought those kinds of investments in the 20th century, because now there is a sense that they have to share them. And so there's this anti-government sentiment that has arisen really dramatically since government moved from being the enforcer of the racial hierarchy for most of our history to the upender of the racial hierarchy after the civil rights movement's successes.
Well, let me ask you about today's politics, whether that truly is a zero-sum game. I mean, it is about winners and losers when it comes to running for election, but also it seems like the policies are that way as well.
Well, that's the narrative, right? Yes, it is true. You know, politics, only one, you know, person can win that seat. But what they're supposed to do when they win that seat is try to support the public good and the common good. And policies like school funding, policies like universal health care, like child care, like higher wages are not zero sum. In fact, we make better policy decisions to put more money in more families' pockets, and that redounds to the larger benefit of all of us as actors in the economy, particularly when you're talking about working and middle-class people, people who are struggling, for whom, you know, an extra, for example, $300 a month per child, like in the child tax credit that was passed as part of the Biden-Harris American Rescue Plan, is going to cut child poverty in half. That's great for those children. That's great for those schools. That's great for those parents. That's great for the criminal justice system and the healthcare system, and on and on and on. But it's this idea, this illusion, this lie that I'm very clear in The Sum of Us is a manufactured story that is broadcast and marketed to all of us, but white Americans are particularly receptive to it, to this idea that some of our status relies on the lesser status of other people, and that we sort of can't trust our fellow American, and that we should see progress for one group of us as being at the expense of the others. That is a lie is a very profitable lie for people who are winning in the economic and political status quo. And in the book, I go back in the history to talk about where that idea was formed, what, you know, what the purpose was, whose interest it served, and then we can then see how it's being revived, you know, honestly, on an hourly basis in conservative media so often.
Well, and picking up on that, you take us, I mean, back to our founding, but also back to the 1950s after the war, and we saw the GI Bill, and we saw, you know, the opening up of housing, of mortgages for middle class families. I should add, largely middle white middle class families, and you saw a strengthening middle class. We saw unions, and then, as you write, with Johnson and the Voting Rights Act and a number of civil rights legislation, the sort of enthusiasm for that kind of government supported policies that helped the middle class kind of got turned on its head when black people were involved.
That's exactly right.
Or were
right.
the beneficiaries, I should say, yes.
Yes, that's really the drain pull politics. I talk about how there were a number of policies and investments in basically in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s that made the middle class as we know it, that created what we now see as the American dream, the largest middle class the world had ever seen, the highest standard of living in the world. And all of those investments, from the massive creation of subsidized housing to the creation of the mortgage market, backed by the federal government, through to the GI Bill, those were largely for whites only, either explicitly, as in the mortgage market and the housing subsidies, which said in their regulations only Caucasians, to the GI Bill, which was race neutral on its face, but excluded most black veterans because of racism in the higher education system and in the housing market. And so what we had was this very pro-government ethos among the majority of white voters because they had benefited from it. They saw it as sort of their right. And in many ways, I think because those benefits and public services and investments and protections were on racially exclusive terms, they kind of felt like it was because they were better, right? Mm-hmm. That it was something that they deserved because of who they were. You know, the narrative was there's something wrong with these other people, these black people. And so you are better than them. And so you deserve these things. And then the civil rights movement won gains that said, you know what, this is actually going to be extended to every American who contributes to this country's great wealth and prosperity. Right? Black people were taxpayers and were not getting the benefits of those taxpayers when it was a whites-only social contract. Black people had obviously contributed so much to this country in our stolen labor and were not getting the rewards from it. And so when the Democratic Party finally said, this is going to be for all of us, there was a massive political shift.
I want to pick up on that after this very short break. That's Heather McGee, our guest. We're talking about her new book, The Sum of Us. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Heather McGee about her new book. It's called The Sum of Us, and it's subtitled What Racism Costs Everyone and How We Can Prosper Together. We're talking about the racial divide, why whites believe that they lose out when people of color are discriminated against. And Heather McGee debunks that idea in her book. She is the board chair of Color of Change, and she was the president of Demos. We want to hear from you. Any questions or comments, you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone and give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499, and we do want to hear from you. Heather, just picking up on what you were saying right before the break, that when civil rights legislation was passed, I guess going back to Johnson, all these programs that had benefited so many white people, whether it was housing or education, all of a sudden were seen very differently when they were applied to black people.
That's right. So in 1956 and 1960, according to one of the sort of gold standard every 4 year social science surveys in the country, the majority of white Americans, in fact, 2/3, almost 70%, believed that the government ought to guarantee a job for everyone who wanted one, who sort of couldn't find one in the private sector, a job guarantee. And the government ought to guarantee a minimum income in the country. These are pretty radical ideas in our current politics, right? A sort of universal basic or minimum income and a job guarantee. And they were popular with nearly 70% of white Americans in 1956 and 1960. And I looked in the data, and by 1964, support for that, those two job and economic guarantees, had fallen in half between 60 and 64. And I thought, okay, maybe this is a mistake in the spreadsheet. No. And it stayed low ever since. And I then tried to puzzle it out, right? What could have happened between 1960 and 1964 to make white Americans turn away from this idea and this sort of general sense that the government should make sure that people had a decent standard of living? 1963, the March on Washington for jobs and freedom, civil rights activists, those ideas, a high minimum wage and a job guarantee, were part of the pretty short list of demands that black activists were visible on the mall demanding. And then 1963 was also the year that President Kennedy went on a media blitz around civil rights, firmly associating what had been the party of the New Deal, the Democratic Party, with civil rights. And of course, we know that his successor, Lyndon Johnson, after signing the Civil Rights and Voting Rights Acts, would become, still to this day, the last Democrat running for president to win the majority of the white vote. And so in many ways, white Americans politically turned their backs on the formula that had created the white middle class because they were being asked to extend that same decency and fairness and opportunity to people that they had been taught were intrinsically less than, people they'd been taught to disdain and distrust. And it's that narrative of racial grievance, of black people asking for something that they don't deserve, that has been really the backbone of right-wing politics ever since. And yet what I try to spell out in The Sum of Us is that that has made, given a support to an economic agenda that has succeeded most in redistributing wealth upwards and upwards and upwards to the point where we've ushered in the inequality era over the last 50 years, where 1% of the population now owns more wealth than 50% than the entire middle class, excuse me, and where 40% of adult workers before the pandemic were paid too little to meet their basic needs. And that has a cost for everyone.
Well, yeah, and let me pick up on a couple of things. One, I was thinking as we march forward to President Ronald Reagan, where misquote him, but I think we all know that, you know, his idea was the worst thing that could happen to you, or almost the worst thing would be, you know, a government agent coming to your door and saying, I'm here to help you, whether he really doubled down on this idea that government is not a force for good or for improvement, but for bad and disimprovement.
That's right. And it was very racialized, his rhetoric, right? He's the one who popularized the myth of the welfare queen, the sense that black people had become, dependent on government, that government basically was for lazy black people. And if you had any self-respect, you would trust the market. Now, what's interesting about that is, of course, government used to be, you know, run exclusively by white men and was mainly benefiting white men. But once integration and women's rights and civil rights and the Immigration Act of 1965 sort of changed the realm of the public into a more inclusive and egalitarian realm, that move to the market, that political move to say, you know what, let's trust corporations and business leaders to make the decisions and we don't need to regulate them or have, you know, labor unions. That's a very racialized and gendered shift of power, right? From a democracy to corporate power, which still to this day, right, wildly overrepresents white men. And so there's a race and gender analysis to what we often talk about in economic policy as a shift from the government to kind of the quote unquote free market. but it's not free for everybody, right? It's still a place of actually unbelievable concentration of power and wealth, and that, you know, immiserates millions of people through low wages and the fight against the kinds of sound, fair taxation that would help us take care of the people's business.
This is jumping to 2021 and to our current president, Joe Biden. I mean, he seems to be wanting to turn what Ronald Reagan was known for saying on its head. He's looking to spend, what, $4 to $6 trillion, in a sense, focusing largely, it hasn't obviously passed Congress yet, but focusing largely on working class and middle class Americans. Do you see this as a shift?
It's a massive shift. You know, in the book, which doesn't pull any punches by any means about sort of describing the extent of racism in our politics and our policymaking, it's really actually a hopeful book. And one of the reasons I had hope was because I started identifying this idea that if what's really holding us back from doing the right, sound, evidence-based thing on so many of our issues is this old lie, this old zero-sum racial hierarchy, and this division that is keeping people who have really common needs apart and divided and unable to win common solutions to those needs, then, in fact, just coming together across lines of race to do what is in everyone's best interest can unlock something I began to call these solidarity dividends. And I raise that because it feels in many ways like the Biden-Harris administration thus far has been moving solidarity dividends. It itself is the result of a multiracial coalition of white folks and young folks and people of color, women coming together at the ballot box. And it is refilling the pool, excuse me, it is refilling the pool of public goods, right? To cut child poverty in half for white, black, brown, indigenous, Asian American families reminds us that poverty was a policy choice and that that really is refilling the pool. And it's going to make many parents just breathe easier. It's going to improve the quality of life of our people. And those solidarity dividends, whether it's you know, the bigger subsidies for healthcare for families who are still struggling with health insurance costs, or it's ripping up all the lead pipes in the country, or it's offering subsidized childcare to working parents who are just not able to make ends meet without help. It really is about what we can solve, how we can get some of these big blocks that are really drowning so many families out of the way, throw someone a lifeline, and let's build better together.
And that is Heather McGee, our guest on Radio Times today. She's got a new book. It's called The Sum of Us, What Racism Costs Everyone and How We Can Prosper Together. We got a lot of people that want to join us. Let me just make sure everyone can join us at radiotimes@whyy.org. That's our email address to join our conversation. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Arthur from Westchester to join our conversation. And Arthur, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you. I'm in so much agreement with what your guest, Ms. McGee, is saying. I even see it beyond that as trying to grow the pie. If we could get blacks and all minorities to be equally engaged, everybody prospers in the long run. But when as an old white guy, when I try and talk to friends of mine about this, and explain it to them that way, all they hear is the constant negativity that whites are the problem, whites are racist, white guys are bad, we've had privilege. And it's hard to get beyond that conversation with people when so much of what they hear is seems to be criticisms of us.
Fair enough, Arthur. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. It was something I wanted to raise with you as well, Heather McGee, which is this difficult conversation about, you know, white privilege and I think a feeling that a lot of white people have. I would not include myself in this. I have to say that they do not have white privilege. How do we wrestle with that?
Yeah. So I think it's really important to engage in this because even now, at a moment when we are making a lot of progress and there is a movement around the country to recognize, to just break free of what has held this country back for so long, the right wing is really trying to stir up resentment and say that people who are trying to fix the problem are the problem, and really keep us divided from something that I think the kinds of solutions to address systemic racism and to eliminate racism in our politics would actually help everyone. So on this question of white privilege, I think it's undoubtedly true, right, that white people have, because of government policies, right, not because white people are individually bad and did something bad to an individual black person, but because of government policies have been set up to succeed while black and brown people have, you know, tremendous headwinds. And what we want to do about that is not take away the good stuff that white people have. It's do what was done for white families with black families too, right? I mean, it's really not about saying we don't want white. So right now, right, white families have better funded schools, better access to healthcare, you know, less job discrimination. We're not saying as racial justice advocates and as progressives that we want white people not to have good schools or good healthcare or good jobs. We're saying we want black and brown families to have that too. And because it's not a zero sum, because we can grow the pie, as your caller mentioned, we really can do better. And in fact, racial inequality is costing the entire economy. And it makes perfect sense, right? Don't you want everyone who's on your team, you know, in a city, in a community, to be able to be on the field scoring points instead of being sidelined because they have too much debt, not enough opportunity, face too much discrimination, right? We have to have this sense that we're all on the same team. And I'm somewhat sympathetic to how easy it would be for a white person today to decide, you know what, I don't want to be the bad guy. Mm-hmm. I don't like this whole conversation because it makes me feel guilty. It makes me feel blamed. I never did anything wrong. You know, I'm turning my back on this whole thing, and I'm going to side with the people who are trying to silence the conversation and trying to keep everything exactly as it is. I get it, right? It's a very, it's an extremely well-funded message, right? It's a massive part of our media ecosystem. For 4 years, it had someone with a big bullhorn in the White House saying that message. And yet, ultimately, what I try to spell out in the Sum of Us is that kind of racial resentment politics, that desire to turn away from problem solving, to not face what's going on, to blame people who are complaining instead of see their common humanity and ask, you're my brother, what can we do together? Is holding us back as a country. It's stopping us from having good jobs for everyone. It's stopping us from tending to our basic infrastructure. It's stopping us from addressing climate change. That's a place that I didn't actually think I was going to find a connection, but I did, between white identity politics and racial resentment and our unwillingness to do what I think I grew up thinking America would obviously do, which is, you know, there's a meteor coming towards the planet. We'd go into the phone booth and suit up, right? That's America. We save the world. We don't destroy it because we're not willing to make some changes and kick fossil fuel companies out of the trough of government subsidies and embrace a new set of technologies. That doesn't seem like America. That's not the America that put a man on the moon. And yet we've been sabotaging ourselves out of this resentment of being a country that is diverse, you know? And if we didn't want to be diverse, then we shouldn't have been founded the way we were.
Too late for that.
We shouldn't have imported millions of people to work in this country. Right. But that's where we are now. So let's get going.
Let me just read a related email, this one from Patricia. I just tuned in and would ask that when referring to white people and the ongoing problems of racism in America, say white racists, white supremacists or racists in general are the problem. I'm a white and all my life have been against racial discrimination. I do not want to be lumped in with the racist. Just to kind of put that out there. Anything you want to say quickly in response to that, Heather?
Yeah, I think it's a really fair point. I think that, you know, not all white people is a really, you know, it's, I understand it. I really do. I also think, though, that when I say white racists or white supremacists, most people see somebody who would take a tiki torch and, you know, go try to assault people in Charlottesville. And I'm talking about the fact that, for example, the majority of white moderates and white conservatives agree with the statement that black people take more from society than we give. That's the majority of white moderates and white conservatives. So that makes you think of a different type of person than when if I were to only be here talking about white supremacists and white racists, right? So I think we need to realize that this story, that there's something wrong with people of color, and that, you know, that there's this zero sum, and the story of racial resentment, that black people don't try hard enough, and that we are coddled by the government, when the reality is really quite the opposite, right? When the reality is that a black college graduate has less household wealth, right, home equity mostly, than a white high school dropout. Let me repeat that. A black college graduate has less average household wealth than a white high school dropout. This is about what policy does to families who are trying to get ahead.
Well, and we're almost...
And so often...
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and so often I just think that we just, you know, the narrative wants to make this problem smaller than it is.
We're almost...
So I'm not saying that your caller is racist. I'm saying that our politics and our policymaking is racist, and that if you are complacent in them, then so often you are actually going along with something that is costing everyone.
Well, we do have to take another short break and we'll get back to our conversation. That's Heather McGee, our guest today on Radio Times. She is board chair of Color of Change, and for many years she was the president of Demos. She's got a new book. That's what we're talking about. It's called The Sum of Us, What Racism Costs Everyone and How We Can Prosper Together. We've got folks that want to join our conversation. You can do it by sending us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Heather McGee. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about what she learned talking to Americans about the racial divide. She spent a couple of years traveling the country, and she found that structural racism hurts not only people of color, but also white Americans as well. Many white people that she talked to believed that progress was a zero-sum game, that if black people gained ground, they would lose out. Her book is an effort to debunk that enduring myth. And again, you can join us, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us at 1-888-477-9499. Heather, let me quote W.E.B. Du Bois, who you quote in your book, and this is a book that he wrote about Black Reconstruction, looking at Black and white Southern workforce. This was the late 19th century. He wrote, "There are probably not today in the world two groups of workers with practically identical interests who hate and fear each other so deeply and persistently, and who are kept so far apart that neither sees anything of common interest." I'm assuming you quoted that that passage from his book on Black Reconstruction in America, because it really applies to today. Help us understand that.
Well, we have a situation where people who are struggling with pretty similar concerns are nonetheless not seeing in one another an ability to band together and make progress. I'm reminded of a young woman that I met named Bridget Hughes in Kansas City, who was a minimum wage fast food worker, right? White working class of Irish descent. And she had worked for, you know, all of her adult life at low poverty wages. She was raising a family on them. And she was approached by other fast food workers who were starting to organize for the Fight for 15 and a union. And she first kind of rejected the idea out of hand. She said, you know, there's no way that they're going to pay somebody like me $15 an hour. Mm. She'd sort of absorbed that sense of a hierarchy of human value, which is really what supports racism, but it also just creates this general sense that some group of people are better than others, that some people are worth far more than others. And she also had absorbed these anti-Black and anti-immigrant attitudes that were just sort of part of what she grew up with, part of the media she listened to. But she took a flyer, right? And she went to the first meeting in an organizing in a basement. And she heard a Latina woman stand up and talk about her own life, having three kids in a two-bedroom apartment with bad plumbing and feeling trapped. And Bridget told me, I saw myself in her. Huh. And she said, you know what? I'm going to sign up. And she began to organize, to talk to other workers, Black and brown, in Kansas City, across the city, and became one of the leaders of the local fight for 15. And now, she says, you know, I used to believe the us versus them stuff, but now I know in order for us to come up, they've got to come up. And that racism is bad for white workers, too, because it keeps us divided from our Black and brown brothers and sisters. That's her telling me that, right? So that's what's going on so often in our economy. Is that people who actually could, by banding together and having more power in numbers, are left in their silos, resentful of other people who are, you know, just struggling just the way they are, probably a little bit worse, and manipulated by millionaires who actually have the power to set their wages and change their lives, and yet they're blaming immigrants and people of color. And that's really... it's as old as the history that W.B. Du Bois was talking about in the South after Reconstruction, when the white sort of post-plantation oligarchy that really kept their grip on Southern politics and power and the economy was basically paying white workers what he called the wages of whiteness, the psychological wages of whiteness, right? The fact that they could say, you're better than Black people. Instead of actually paying them high and decent wages.
But do you see this, I mean, there's so many issues at play here, but do you see this as a class issue, that there's something structural about the, you know, the super wealthy and the way the system has benefited so many rich people that keeps the more working class, lower classes, if I can use that word, sort of at each other's throats and the people at the top, you know, get their 401ks and their tax breaks.
That's exactly right. Because when we have had instances of greater class solidarity, people, no matter what their background, who come together, we have had politics that have been more fair and more inclusive and, you know, have had faster rates of economic growth, by the way. And that's really what it's about. I come at these questions from an economic perspective, trying to figure out why it is that we have such an unequal society and why the majority of white Americans continue to vote for a plutocracy, continue to vote for a party that, you know, gets into office and slashes tax rates on people who are already some of the richest people the world had ever seen, while we can't seem to find money to fix, you know, basic things in our infrastructure, and while working families spend all day away from their families and then come home unable to feed them at night, right? That to me doesn't feel like the American dream. That to me feels like a massive betrayal of white, Black, and brown families. And yet the resentment politics, these culture wars, this, you know, today's version of it is about Dr. Seuss and right. Cancel culture and, you know, critical race theory and 1619 Project, none of which have any actual substance to them, none of which are an actual threat to the survival of struggling white families. And yet that's the politics. And that's the campaigning and the message in the media. And then what they would actually do in power is take more money away from working people, break up unions more, cut taxes more for wealthy people, shifting the burden onto people who are already struggling.
Let me read a comment from Rob, who says, I agree with what your author is saying, but in my experience, it's complicated. My mother was a refugee from the pogroms and came to this country and experienced a lot of challenges. Is it always about the color of someone's skin that determines inequality? And of course, we have a history of immigrants, refugees coming to this country and facing discrimination on a whole host of levels. Can you speak to that, Heather?
Yes, I'm by no means saying, and I think really my point is that this system, the unfairness of the American economy, the hierarchy and the sort of brutal hierarchy of the American economy, does not mean that white people get a free pass. I think that's not at all what I've been saying. I've been saying that it is worse here for everyone than it would be if we had more social solidarity. I said, why can't Americans seem to have nice things? That includes so many millions of white-skinned Americans who are still struggling in an economy that pays CEOs $10,000 an hour with a shower of tax breaks and basically, you know, a lack of accountability for, you know, whatever they might do, whether it's pollute or defraud or, you know, and then there's so much accountability for working class families and they're paid $8 an hour, right? And that includes, of course, white-skinned people. But my point is that the central problem stopping this country from living up to its ideals is racism in our politics and policy. And that has a cost for everyone.
People might be surprised, and I have to say, having read your book and read some reviews about the book and interviews that you've done, is that you actually have some degree of optimism for this country, having talked to a lot of Americans about what they want and finding this solidarity dividend that you write about in this book.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I think I set out on the journey to write the book out of frustration, and I left, you know, with a lot of hope, because all across the country, and this is not what's in front page news, this is not what gets the clicks and the tweets, because it's not outrageous, but people are doing what Bridget did, the fast food worker in Kansas City, and seeing that they have common hopes and dreams and struggles with people across lines of race, rejecting the zero sum, turning off the toxic politics and saying, let's roll up our sleeves together, let's link arms, and let's do something great for our communities. The final chapter of my book is called The Solidarity Dividend, and I go to Lewiston, Maine, which is one of those dying mill towns, as they're called, in Maine, the whitest state in the nation. And there I talk to white middle-aged folks whose lives have been transformed because they have rolled up their sleeves and started working with what they call New Mainers, these black Muslim refugees and immigrants who have revitalized the main street and the local economy of this town. Now, the politics were terrible, right? The mayor was anti-immigrant, and, you know, the governor of Maine at the time was a kind of mini proto-Trump and, you know, talked about cutting welfare because of illegal immigrants and, you know, in a state that's 90% white and quite impoverished, right? Tried to sort of scapegoat the issue of welfare onto black and brown people while cutting taxes for wealthy vacationers, right? The sort of classic right-wing jujitsu, the dog whistle politics. And yet, in spite of that, you had people on the ground really seeing themselves in one another and doing what was right and good for their communities and being transformed by it. And I found stories of that all over the country. The Fight for 15 itself, I think, is a massive solidarity dividend across the country. It's delivered $70 billion back into the pockets of hardworking people, has put the issue of a living wage on the national agenda, and it's been driven by the people at the bottom of the pay scale, and in many ways at the bottom of the cultural hierarchy, right? Burger flippers, people that we degrade in the national conversation so often. And yet it's been a real multiracial coalition, and that gives me hope.
Well, you know, it's funny you said that. There's this question about, you know, how to get more people back to work. And I saw that Chipotle wants to start paying people $15 an hour, kind of supply and demand. But mm-hmm. they, you know, they, hopefully that's going to be a benefit coming out of the pandemic.
Yeah, it really has to be. Of course, what the right wing wants to do is cut unemployment insurance instead of raise wages or have the market work, right? Because what employers are finding is that if they raise wages and make these jobs not poverty jobs, when often, you know, schools are still not still open, people are struggling to have childcare in the pandemic. It's not adding up. It didn't add up before the pandemic, right? 40% of adult workers were paid too little to make ends meet. And yet this has been a real reset. And it's a reset for an unequal economy where businesses have been free riders. They've gotten tax cuts and public subsidies, and they haven't had to pay their workers. They've been able to channel the profits of their workers disproportionately to shareholders, who are people who are often already rich, and to the executive class. And it's time that businesses start having to pay the people who bake the pie all day, right? Mm-hmm. And give them a decent slice of it. And that is what is going to get people back to work. That and offering childcare and health care and things that people really need to make it all add up.
Let me read a comment from George who says, if this were put in terms of helping the poor and working class, regardless of race, it would more likely succeed. Racializing the wealth gap is divisive and ultimately a dead end. Is he onto something there?
I'm so glad that your listener made that comment, because that's what I tried to do, right? For 20 years, we were trying to, refund public college to make college debt-free again, as it used to be back when the majority, vast majority, 90%+ of college goers were white, right? Because the government picked up the tab by funding college and by doing grants and not loans. That's what we tried to do when we tried to make the case for so many of these economic policies. And yet, here's the thing. For most white Americans, these economic conversations, when you say poverty, they see black anyway. And that's the mistake we made, was to ignore how much the conversation was already racialized. How much, when you're talking about things like the minimum wage, things like poverty, things like healthcare, things like government spending in general, they're already so racialized. This was something I really learned when I sat with so many sociologists and political scientists. There's a 60 percentage point gap between a white person with low racial resentment and high racial resentment in terms of their support for more government spending. For example, the Affordable Health Care Act, right? The Affordable Care Act. It's a pretty modest thing, right? And includes an expansion of Medicaid for people who are really minimum wage workers around that level, who obviously are not getting health care on the job because profitable corporations don't want to give it to them. And so where else are they going to get it, making $10,000 a year, right? And yet, most white Americans oppose the Affordable Care Act. And yet, when you describe it to them as just as the provisions of the bill and say that it was Bill Clinton's proposal, right? This is something a social scientist did during the debate over the Affordable Care Act. They were more supportive of it, right? Mm. It was the idea that it was Obama, the fear of a black man in government redistributing, taking something away from white people and giving it to black people, this sort of zero-sum fear. And so, unfortunately, I wish that your caller was right, that people who want to make things better could just stop talking about race and then white people, the majority of white people would think, okay, great, let's have affordable health care. But that's not what our history has shown us. That's not what today's politics show us, right? We have this Mason-Dixon line of health care, right, where the majority of states in the former Confederacy have refused free money from the government to provide health care to their working class citizens of all races, majority white. And it's because of that racialized politics.
Heather McGee, we have to leave it there. Thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And again, her book is called The Sum of Us, What Racism Costs Everyone and How We Can Prosper Together. We appreciate all those comments and calls to Radio Times. You can always download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.